What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review, where we'll be taking a look at the big stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, Australia puts up $100 million for the Pacific's latest climate fund, Fiji to open up its controversial embassy in Jerusalem, and after months of delay, Pacific liaison workers finally get paid for their job. We'll have more on those stories coming up right here on Pacific Review, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. But first, the Pacific's largest political meeting has wrapped up in the Solomon's capital, Honiara. Australia's Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, was among the dozens of leaders attending the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting. Leaders are already claiming a win from this week's meeting with the setup of a critical climate fund they say will make a difference on the ground. The ABC Solomon Islands reporter Chris and Rita Omani-Leong takes a look at this new climate fund.
Manasa Sovaki is the headman of Buretu village in Fiji. It's a beautiful part of the world, but also one of the hardest hit by the impacts of climate change.
The main thing is the rising of sea level in our village. Cause the damage of our plantation and the source of living every day.
But through a decision made on another island this week, Manasa's village may soon see positive change. At this week's Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting in Honiara, the ratification of the Pacific Resilience Facility, or the PRF for short, is being claimed as a big win.
We are finally establishing our first international financial institution owned by the Pacific Islands Forum Fund, which will be hosted in the Kingdom of Tonga.
That was PIF Chair and Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele. PM Manele says the PRF is Pacific's response to climate change, a funding model for the Pacific led by the Pacific.
The Pacific Resilience Facility is an idea. It's an idea whose time has come, and it's a manifestation of our deeper collective desire for the Blue Pacific to reduce dependency and vulnerability.
The Climate Fund has taken a decade for Pacific leaders to create and has a goal of generating $750 million by next year. So far, pledges of close to $300 million have been received, with Australia committing $100 million to the fund. Earlier this week, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said climate change was a global challenge and Australia had a responsibility to help.
In the Pacific, we need to provide support for our Pacific family members.
Pacific Islands Forum Secretary General Baron Wanga says capital confidence in the PRF will be assured by the solidarity and the unity of the forum.
Climate finance is not just about money. It is about equity, justice and fairness.
But the Pacific Islands Climate Action Network argues the monetary goal is not ambitious enough to cover the impacts of climate change. Sindra Sharma is the international policy lead.
From our calculations, we know that per annum, it's around $1 billion per annum. So, $500 million is not adequate to be able to resolve all the significant adaptation and loss in responses to loss and damage that our island communities will need.
She says although the PRF will resolve some issues in terms of accessing finance, they are yet to see what it means at a community level.
Our understanding is that it will allow grant-based access to finance for communities, but some of the concerns is that there doesn't seem to have been much consultation with communities in terms of how that finance will flow to them.
For communities like Mburetu Village, the Pacific Resilience Facility could mean that critical adaptation activities, such as the reinforcement of its coastal structures, can now be financed. Headman Manase Sovaki welcomes it, saying these structures are needed so his village can once again grow crops and sell them at the market. His message is simple.
We need help from the climate finance to help us.
And that was Manasa Sovaki. He's the headman of Mburetu Village in Fiji. Ending that report from Chris and Rita Omanu-Leong in Honiara, with additional support from the ABC's Fiji reporter, Lithe Movono. And we stay at the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting in Solomon Islands. The ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgett, has been covering it. And I caught up with Stephen for the latest out of that meeting. After a week in Honiara, were there any surprises that you saw in your time there?
No, there were no massive surprises this week. I think, broadly speaking, the Solomon Islands government is probably going to be quite relieved with how things have gone. There weren't any big dramatic developments in terms of dialogue partners. There was a bit of speculation at the beginning of this week and even last week that some countries, particularly perhaps China and the US, would effectively ignore the directive that Pacific leaders gave to exclude all dialogue partners from this meeting. So there was speculation about senior US diplomats or Chinese diplomats coming to Honiara anyway and blowing in on the meetings or holding their own side meetings with Pacific leaders in the same venues or around the city. As best as I can tell, that hasn't happened. Whilst there have certainly been plenty of activity from both US and Chinese diplomats in the region, in Honiara, there hasn't been any sort of concerted attempt, deliberate attempt, to muscle in on these meetings. They've respected the call for space.
Now, before we get more into the absence of development partners, Stephen, you've been covering Pacific Island Forum Leaders meetings for quite some time now. In terms of the past week, what have been the key outcomes of this meeting taking place in Honiara?
I think the declaration and ratification of the Pacific Resilience Facility was a big moment. It hasn't drawn huge amounts of media attention, but this has been a long-standing problem for the Pacific, that they simply haven't had access to the climate that they need to deal with escalating disasters. Now, that's partly because accessing a lot of this funding through multilateral funds is a complicated and wieldy and difficult process for Pacific Island governments. The hope is that the PRF will over time change that by setting up this fund that's operated from the Pacific by Pacific nationals. That will really free up finance. That's not to say that it will solve all these problems instantly. It's worth remembering that the PRF so far has only got a relatively modest amount of money, well under $200 million in there. It wants to get to $500 million pretty quickly. Even that, though, is a fairly small amount when you consider the huge climate needs that are already emerging across the Pacific. And then, of course, it does want to radically scale up after that. But whether it can achieve that is a difficult question. It will require them and Pacific leaders finding ways to loosen the pockets of international organisations and particularly of foreign governments to convince them that this is the place where money should be invested.
Do you think their absence from this week's meeting had a negative impact on things like the Pacific Resilience Facility and the need for more donors to be on board?
Yeah, when we asked the head of the Pacific Resilience Facility, she gave a very diplomatic answer saying that she was sure that Pacific nations would be able to make that same pitch to the UN at the UN General Assembly later this month, up in just a week or two. So she dismissed any concerns or didn't want to buy in on that question. But others, like Peter Cantaloria Jr. And some officials I've spoken to privately here, say that they do believe it was a missed opportunity, that it would have been great to have an opportunity to make that pitch to people from dialogue partners who could loosen purse strings, and that doing it in the Pacific rather than in New York would have been more effective. So I think you can mount a credible argument that that was a missed opportunity for Pacific Island nations, and that it would have been helpful to have the dialogue partners here.
And that was the ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts. Now, he's been reporting from the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting in the Solomon Islands capital, Honiara. You're listening to Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka, keeping you up to date with all the latest news coming out of the Pacific region. The Fiji government is pushing ahead with its controversial plan to establish an embassy in Jerusalem, with a diplomatic post to be opened later this week. Human rights activists have expressed alarm as it coincides with an escalation of violence in Gaza, where tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians have been killed in attacks by the Israel military. They say this latest move by Fiji undermines the government's Ocean of Peace concept. Finau Fonua with this report.
Israel. I'm from Fiji.
No matter what the United Nations says or the European Union, we would like to encourage you and comfort you.
The Bible says, I will bless those who bless you, Israel, and I will curse those who curse you.
A group of Fijian evangelists laud Israel in a social media video. It's a popular religious sentiment found in a number of Pacific countries. Earlier this year, 7 of only 12 countries that opposed the UN vote that called for a ceasefire in Gaza were Pacific Island countries. And next week, Fiji will become one of only 6 in the world that will have an embassy in Jerusalem. And the country's Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rambuka, is expected to be there.
So the nation of Israel has been a conduit to humanity, showing us what God is like, his heart, his love towards humanity.
But outside of the Pacific Islands, public outrage against Israel has already reached a boiling point amidst ever-increasing reports of massacres, displacement, and forced starvation of Palestinian civilians at the hands of the Israeli military.
Today I can confirm that at the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly in September, Australia will recognise the state of Palestine.
Just 2 weeks ago, Australia, along with the United Kingdom, New Zealand and Canada, announced their intentions to recognise a Palestinian state before the end of this month. Fiji's diplomatic move is widely condemned, as it occurs during what virtually every human rights organisation has called a genocide.
We, of course, are very shocked and we're totally against it.
Shamima Ali, coordinator of the Fiji Women's Crisis Centre, believes Rambuka's decision panders to popular religious sentiment in Fiji.
Rambuka is playing to the masses. I don't believe that he is stupid enough to go along with this whole thing of the lost tribe of Israel and so on. I think it's just going along, you know, buying votes because he does know where the majority sentiments are.
We commit to you the leaders, O God, of the state of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister, all the members of his cabinet, the Knesset. We pray for the Israeli Defense Forces.
I think it goes back to the idea of the biblical Israel and the way in which our indigenous communities in Fiji connect to that.
Georgi Ravulo, a prominent Fijian academic at the University of Sydney, says a religious devotion to the modern state of Israel is entrenched among many Fijians.
I think because we've connected our understanding of our religious identities with Israel being a big part of that, I think that's where we're in support of the idea of Israel as a group of people. But I think that's where the point of difference is. Israel as a nation state needs to be further understood.
On Monday, the Fiji government reiterated its motive behind the decision, saying it respected the rights of Palestinians. The statement read,
Fiji condemns all forms of violence against civilians and stands with the international community in calling for humanitarian relief for those affected. Establishing a mission in Jerusalem or engaging diplomatically with Israel does not mean endorsing war or harm. It is an act of engagement intended to build bridges and promote dialogue.
It is a false statement. It holds no truth and it is contradictory.
Roshiko Deo is a senior activist at the Fijians for Palestine Solidarity Network. She says the political statement is oblivious to the reports of mass murder.
Completely ignoring the fact that organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Save the Children, Christian Aid, Doctors Without Borders, Medical Sans Frontier, so many humanitarian and international human rights organizations, there is so much information and it is completely being ignored by our government.
Ah.
I am told that the Pacific leaders embrace the concept or the idea of the Pacific being declared or agreed to be a zone of peace or an ocean of peace.
The Ocean of Peace concept calls for a Pacific region free of geopolitical competition and unconsumed by global conflicts. It's an agenda currently being championed by Prime Minister Rambuka at the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting in Honiara. But many civil society leaders say the idea is being jeopardized by support for Israel.
An ocean of peace means consistency.
Fijian Reverend James Bhagwan is one civil society leader in attendance at the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting. He's the General Secretary of the Pacific Conference of Churches and says establishing an embassy in Jerusalem is incompatible with the Ocean of Peace concept.
Well, if Fiji proceeds with this opening of an embassy in Jerusalem, it does indeed sit uneasily with the vision of an Ocean of Peace, which is one that is demilitarized, that is decolonizing, and of course is grounded in international law. We don't short-circuit self-determination abroad while calling for it at home.
That was Reverend James Bhagwan. He is the General Secretary of the Pacific Conference of Churches. And Pacific Review has reached out to the Fiji government for comment on this story. And that report was by the ABC's Finau Fonua. The Pacific Labor Mobility Scheme is no stranger to allegations of exploitation and abuse. The program has been hit with problems in recent years. And now, country liaison officers, many of whom are funded by the Australian government, say they've gone for weeks and sometimes months without pay. The ABC's Lucy Cooper with more.
Underpaid by $16,000, Rosa Muller-Norman was at a loss.
I feel bad. I feel terrible about the situation, the treatment of myself.
At the start of last year, Rosa took up a new role as a country liaison officer, or CLO. It's a vital job many have never heard of. 17 CLOs are employed to support more than 30,000 workers under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility, or PALM, scheme. They act as a conduit between employers and workers, helping with language barriers, pay, welfare, health and cultural issues.
The liaison officer is there to guide them sometimes, advise them, you know, even tell them off sometimes, you know. We tell them, remember your culture, you don't do this just because you're away from home. Don't get carried away.
Rosa is one of several CLOs who told the ABC that they went weeks, and in Rosa's case, more than 6 months without pay. While country liaison officers are funded by Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, DFAT, their pay is managed by the Pacific Island governments who send the workers. Because Rosa is from Kiribati and supported workers from there, the Kiribati government was responsible for her delayed payments.
The first issues were when we hadn't been paid for so long, for many months. We kept asking them, we did ask them, when are we going to be paid?
When Rosa tried to chase the money, the Kiribati government asked her for forms and bank details she had already provided. She also alleges that her former employer, Kiribati's Overseas Employment Unit, misappropriated the money it received from the Australian government for her wages.
I just feel like it was a deal in tactics. But when we went there in November, December, we had like an induction back there. And we asked them why the delay in the payments. And they said the funding had been used for some other project. The funding that was sent specifically for our wages. And yeah, we just couldn't believe that that's what they had done. And then that's why we didn't receive all our due payments, because the funding had been used for something else.
Rosa is not alone.
I would be without wages for 2 months, 3 months, and then I'll get my pay coming in.
David Patanvanu started as a country liaison officer in mid-2024.
We'll come across cases where they, you know, there's something not right, you know, either be they pay or accommodation, overcrowded and all those stuff. So that's when we change caps now and we help the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations.
Born in Vanuatu in 2020, David came to Australia under the PALM scheme to pick tomatoes in regional New South Wales. He too faced issues with his pay soon after commencing his role as a CLO.
The funding was never consistent. I'd get it late and I'm in Australia and I always have to fight back to Vanuatu to try and get the system going, because the Australian government would do their part in paying through to the Vanuatu government, and the, you know, the internal financial process of acquiring the funds through the department was a lengthy process that sometimes just takes forever.
David went for weeks at a time without receiving his wage. He said the only way to get it was in person.
I've exhausted those calling in and emailing over 100 times, ringing in every morning and every afternoon. Once I've completed those approach or those attempts, then the last resort was for me to fly in.
David's experience as a CLO left him questioning how effective he could be. If no one supported him, how could he support others?
It's just a role that has been not really looked after. Like, we were supposed to be the ones that are providing welfare and wellbeing support. And what about our welfare and wellbeing?
The Vanuatu government declined the ABC's request for comment. Experts are calling for reform to country liaison officer payments, saying they should be paid directly by the Australian government for their work.
It's completely unacceptable that pivotal welfare staff like country liaison officers are going unpaid.
That's Matt Withers, an Australian National University researcher.
They are frequently overstretched and unable to meet the needs of all palm workers, particularly those in remote locations and communities.
Mr. Withers has been studying the palm scheme for the past 6 years. He says more clothes need to be employed to support workers, but how they are paid needs to be addressed first.
I think it would make a lot more sense to directly fund these positions through the Pacific Labour Mobility Support Program to ensure timely payment for the work that is being conducted by these clothes, while their day-to-day work and operations could remain within the remit of those Pacific Island countries.
The ABC has been told that DFAT is updating its mechanisms for co-funding CLO positions, and an outcome regarding this is expected by the end of the year. Rosa Muller-Norman was paid just once, a total of $785 in the 14 months she was employed as a CLO. She's since been paid in full. The Kiribati government sent her a further two payments, but it was the Australian government which had to step in and send her the remaining balance of the $16,000 which she was owed, as well as overtime and other related costs. In an email seen by the ABC, Australia's Pacific Labour Mobility Support Program told Rosa that the payment was being processed in exceptional circumstances only due to the significant delays you have experienced in payment. It was a huge relief for Rosa.
Now that I'm not involved anymore, in a way I'm happy that I got my life back, because it was just constant.
A DFAT spokesperson said that the department was aware of issues of delayed payments for some clothes from some palm scheme sending country governments, and that the department has zero tolerance for inaction on fraud and corruption. The Kiribati government did not respond to the ABC's request for comment. What started out as a desire to help workers from her home country has left Rosa feeling disillusioned.
They just need to be more professional about things. Paperwork, be on time with payment, what they require, who needs what exactly, so they can flow freely. But yeah, I'm glad I'm out of it, but I just don't want it to carry on like what it has been.
And that was former country liaison worker Rosa Muller-Norman ending that report from the ABC's Lucy Cooper. After one term in office, where she made history as Samoa's first woman prime minister, Fiame Naomi Mataafa has stepped down from office. It follows last week's vote counting, which put the rival FAST party as the winner of the general election, and Laauli Leuteschmid as the country's next prime minister. For Fiame, it marks the next stage of her political career, one which will see her representing her constituency of Lotofanga from the opposition bench.
I congratulate the Prime Minister-elect, the Honourable Laauli Malietoa Leuwatea Polataibaufosi. I pray for wisdom and courage upon you to carry the mantle of leadership with dedication and integrity. I want to acknowledge with sincere appreciation my cabinet colleagues who have served with me during the 17th parliamentary term. Thank you for your service to the country. In closing, I acknowledge with appreciation the support of my constituency, Lotofanga. We have come a long way and stood together over these many years. Thank you for your prayers, your counsel, and ready support during the 40 years I have been your Member of Parliament, and your continued support for the next 5 years.
And that was Fiame Naomi Mataafa, Samoa's former Prime Minister, stepping down from office, with Samoa's new Prime Minister to be announced next week. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific region. Pacific Review is produced on the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation.